Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. We meet to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining. Our journalist and novelist, Margaret Wampler.
Well, hey there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How's it going?
Good. I'm really loving the floral.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I had to wear a light shirt because this week I learned that if you get lemon juice on yourself and then sit in the sun, you can get a horrible chemical burn.
Oh, I thought that's just how girls in high school did their highlights.
Yes. Well, if I do that to my stomach, there are three horrible welts that are clearly in the shape of me wiping lemon juice on my stomach. It's terrible. We've also got academic and dyke about town, Karen Thompson.
Hi, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Karen, you just came back from your big fete of the year.
The big music nerd fete up at the Museum of Pop Culture called the PopCon or Pop Conference, and it was great. I had a round table with some really amazing writers about Quiet Storm and soft rock.
Nice.
Like, I think so much from the 80s has come back, but I feel like that Hall & Oates-y magic has not been returning to us. Is it a coming?
Oh, I don't think it's ever really left. At least since, you know, as Jason King, one of my co-panelists, argued, Babyface. Like he does like a cover of Bread's If, that kind of thing. You know, there's a lot going on.
So was some Luther Vandross played or referenced?
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Lots.
Good.
Yeah, certainly.
Delicious.
And of course, we were missing our signature hello, hello. Winter Mitchell is going away for a period of time to work on some other stuff. So we have her temporary permanent replacement, the host of Yo, Is This Racist, Mr. Andrew T.
What up, what up?
Andrew, is that going to be your signature hello?
I think, what if I can either try a new one every week I'm here or go with what up, what up.
I mean, I kind of like what up, what up.
I feel like it's just enough of a twist. It's familiar to people, but not, you know, too biting winter style.
Also, like, we need bro energy in here.
I was just going to say, we have a hetero male back in the house.
Some of you out there.
Let's not scare him away, guys.
Karen is giving dapper mask. I am giving conversation dominating mask. But it's nice to have some, like, I just got done playing b-ball with my boys.
Oh, yeah. So sweaty from the basketball.
And tell people a little bit more about you.
I host a podcast and I write a blog, I guess, a Q&A blog called Yo, Is This Racist? Where I'm going to fix it. I'm going to fix the racism. And not this week, but next week, if you're going to tune in, changing stuff up. So it's going to be a special episode starting the 9th.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
It's a great show.
Thank you.
But this is our show, so let's do this show and not focus on that.
Let me say this. This is a much less stressful show.
Yes. We're not dealing with the big issues of the day, just TV. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about season 2 of Westworld. We're going to try to process our relationship to stories about robots with feelings and cable dramas that feel the need to be opaque. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Andrew, you're all new and everything. What are you all about this week?
I had sort of two or one and a half ones. I am all about watching Infinity War, the Avengers of Infinity War, and not really remembering a single thing that you need to know going into it. It was so confusing. I don't know if anyone else has seen it, but the first act and a half really feels truly like the most expensive web series put together. Like, just everything's a 7-minute scene, kind of connects, and then it all kind of comes together, but it's so confusing.
My friend Rebecca Cohen, who is a cartoonist, she said, we've had superhero movies before, but these movies are maybe the first comic book movies in the way that they are a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this complete Paul on the Road to Damascus moment after
Captain America Civil War,
where I was like, oh God, it's a soap opera. I have to figure out how these things come together. And so I made myself go back and rewatch all of them. This weekend, I went back and watched The Thors
so
I could figure out where the red stone was.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I did none of those things. I like kind of half listened to one podcast where they kind of recapped everything, and I just nothing made any sense.
But you had to enjoy like getting Tony Stark and Doctor Strange in the same room. Like...
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it was all very fun, but I just kept on feeling like I know I'm missing something. But my jam is being fine with it.
Yes.
Being fine with missing it. I'm just like, it's fine. I don't care. I'm having a good enough time.
And what was your other jam?
My other jam was because we're doing Westworld, I went to the Ren Fair on Sunday. So I went to Westworld.
Like, where was it? In
Irwindale.
Oh, in Irwindale.
Yeah.
I had no idea that so many people cosplay Westworld characters. Like, namely Evan Rachel Wood's character.
Yeah, that seems like
the
most...
Like, if you go on Instagram and just do the hashtag Westworld, you see tons of women dressing up as
her. That seems... I like cosplay that is achievable enough so it's not too complicated. I don't like when they're cutting a lot of stuff out of foam core and, like, making big swords.
But did you dress up for the Ren Fair?
Not only did I not dress up, I... couldn't, like, because they hold character, basically, so it's all Milord and Milady mm-hmm. for the whole time. And I just, like, I kind of looked at one bartender at one point. I was like, can I just get a beer? And she's like, yeah, it's fine. Here you go.
I love the Ren Fair so much. I love going to the little shows and, like, figuring out these people who travel from Ren Fair to Ren Fair being, like, surly washerwomen. It's so great. And also, I just want to buy cloaks.
I once had to be a wench in a Madrigal ensemble.
Wonderful.
When I was in, I think it was, like, maybe... college, my first year of college, and I was in the whole bodice and the whole getup, and had my mead stein, the whole thing.
Confession, I've never been to one, but I think I'm going to wait until Silas is about 3 or 4 when he can, like, appreciate it. And
that
we'll
will
go.
Seem magic. Right? Yeah.
Oh, that's true. I went with a friend who has a kid.
Yeah.
And so the most magical was seeing it through the kid's eyes, because for me, I was like, I'm...
Yeah,
tiny bit hungover, and I just want to be in a field. Yeah, yeah. But the kid was having so much fun; she just jumped, mostly jumped. That's all the rides for like under fives ultimately are like basically a trampoline.
Well, there's something cool about going
or like a spinning teacup.
Yeah,
going to an amusement park with no infrastructure. You know, like it's just dirt and people trying hard.
Yeah, dirt. I mean, it's all about the performance.
Yeah,
it's like the carny element.
There was a little. Well, in this one, anyway. Okay.
But also, like, the lady equivalent of carnies of, like, busty woman who tours selling, like, crystal roses and stuff
like that.
Yeah, I'm down.
A lot of crystals, a lot of ointments. The carny aspect was all the carny games were...
Are you sure this wasn't just, like, Echo Park boutiques or something?
It was... so close to that. And that's the thing, really. It was like
a deck of tarot cards?
A 20-minute drive, and I'm like, this is not appreciably different than the Silver Lake Farmer's Market.
That's very funny. Karen Thompson, about what are you?
Alexis Bledel, Alexis Bledel, Alexis Bledel in Handmaid's Tale Season 2. Emily, the character she plays, formerly known as Ofglen, or Ofglen, has returned in a more central way to Season 2 of The Handmaid's Tale. One of the things that we're getting from the series, obviously, is we've left the world of the book, the Wookiee. We've left the world of the book behind. And so this is really the creators of the show, in consultation with Margaret Atwood, trying to figure out how to flesh out these various stories. So we get to go into backstories that didn't exist in the context of the literary narrative. And we learned so much more about Emily. And her story particularly touched me, obviously, because she's not only, you know, a lesbian, but she's also a professor. And that was her life in the past was as a professor. So you see her in the pre sort of Gilead world as being haunted by and being within the context of this university purge that they refer to. And honestly, I mean, it really touches upon my greatest fears in the contemporary moment, precisely around the winnowing of free speech and the targeting specifically of LGBT faculty. There's also a really dramatic scene where you see them at the airport, her and her family at the airport. Her wife is played by Clea DuVall, by the way, for all you sapphic sisters out there. Mm-hmm. You see how the ICE, the Border Patrol, essentially, or what does ICE stand for?
Oh, God.
Immigration Customs Enforcement?
Customs. Yes. Okay, yes. Yeah. Immigration Customs Enforcement. how the rules change up very quickly as she approaches each stand, each layer of approval to try to get to this flight to leave the U.S.
Wear the red dress. Wear the wings. Shut your mouth. Be a good girl. Roll over and spread your legs. Yes, ma'am. May the Lord open. Seriously? What the actual...
It made me think a lot of the stories that people were sharing about, like, the early days of confusion, particularly around the first Muslim ban.
Yeah.
And how, you know, these petty bureaucrats were taking it upon themselves to enact violences of the state without any kind of clarity around it. And, you know, Rory Gilmore, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, we now see Alexis Bledel's acting chops. We see her chew up some scenery with Marissa Tomei. I'm not going to spoil too much, but one of the things that's really exciting is I hope this is a harbinger of us getting to see some of these other characters have a more fully fleshed out backstory and set of experiences, because, you know, Emily is now in the colonies having suffered from her disobedience. And so we get a glimpse at what those colonies that were referred to in the first season really look like.
And she still had the operation, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes, she, you know, in the first season, she was essentially given a forced clitoridectomy.
Yeah.
And so she's still, you know, existing in that space of violence. But one of the lovely things is that with especially using Alexis Bledel to take a character who you think is going to behave with empathy and have her act with complete impunity.
Well, the wonderful thing about Clea Duvall being her wife was it's like, oh my God, she's the femme in this relationship. Yeah. Like, because she is such a, like, hard brass tacks character. And then, like, seeing her with her family in those times when she was, like, a softer person not prepared for this, it's delicious.
Yes. So, last time we talked about Handmaid's Tale, we decided it's really not a bingeable show. Mm-hmm. And do you feel like so far there's only this episode out.
Two episodes
out. But do you feel like it's still keeping with that type of intensity where, like, you need a refresher after watching it? Like, I posted something on our Instagram account about it, and somebody said that they had to watch Moana after this episode.
Oh, I definitely had to palate cleanse. I think that I actually feel like this season feels darker. Even.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing.
It's more intense, and I think I turned on Alex Inc. to fall asleep.
Yeah.
Just because I knew this.
Yeah, you'd need to, like, hold on to a teddy bear after this episode, it sounds like.
So, yeah. I do think that it's not going to function in a bingeable way for people. So you can't, like, unless you're really, you know, looking for, I don't know, looking to put yourself through the ringer. Maybe Let's, never emerge again.
I was going to say this might be the worst of straight guy armor, but I think I'm going to have to try to catch up this week. So I think I've got, what, like 14 hours of it ahead of me between now and next
week. It's a real light, breezy thing to blow through.
One thing is, like, Atwood's novel was never the most functional of sci-fi worlds. Like, trying to understand, like, that there are only... Who are the regular people? Everybody's a captain. Everybody we see is a captain. We're only seeing sort of like the upper levels of life in Gilead because June's perspective is so restricted.
Yeah. There are so many blind corners in that book, but that's what makes it creepy at the same time.
And the thing is it, like the show, the first season of the show was a little bit worse because there were things like you didn't even see the, like, utility wives or whatever they were called, or Econo wives. You, like, and the scenes at the Boston Globe where you're just sort of re-encountering what happened and sort of, like, giving you more scenes from, like, her having to ask her husband's permission to get birth control and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's nice fleshing out that world and making it feel more whole.
Yeah, absolutely.
Margaret, we have a shared all about this week.
We do, Guy. I knew you'd want to come in and talk about this.
Yes.
And it's, of course, all the furor that's happening over the White House Correspondents' Dinner, particularly Michelle Wolf's jokes about Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So it's a little curious why this particular set seems to have riled up so many people. But it made me start thinking about, like, well, what is the Correspondents' Dinner in the first place? Like, what is the foundation of this thing? And I just went and read some, like, quick history about it that I thought I'd share. It started in 1921 with just 50 men in a room. They got their first president in there with Calvin Coolidge in 1924. And in 1962, Helen Thomas pressured JFK to lift the women's ban.
There was a women's ban?
Of course there was. It's
supposed to be ribald gentlemen, right?
Yes, it was only supposed to be the most esteemed gentleman. And basically why I'm telling you all this is because the roots of this thing is totally a man's society. It's a good old boys club. And I think part of the reason that this set particularly riled up people is because a woman came in there and took down every power structure she could see.
Margaret, I'm pretty sure that a female comedian's job is to come in and be 85% as mean as a man. So it seems like she's doing what a man does, but also doesn't make anybody unhappy.
I think that's exactly what people expect. And so everyone was mad that she, like, went just as cutthroat as Seth Meyers or Stephen Colbert or anyone else who's ever done it.
There's also, of course, Ivanka. She was supposed to be an advocate for women, but it turns out she's about as helpful to women as an empty box of tampons. She's done nothing to satisfy women. So I guess, like father, like daughter. Oh, you don't think he's good in bed. Come on.
The gender element of this is fascinating to me because, A, why the fuck get Michelle Wolf? Because she's not the most famous person on the planet, but she is a hard joke writer. Like, she is a hard joke writer, and she really brought it. It was so funny. And one of the things that was most fascinating is the fact that people are preoccupied with these jokes that a woman made about other women that did not fall into the pits that men traditionally use for making fun of women. She criticized these women on their job performance, and then the next day, Mika Brzezinski was saying, I watched a wife and mother's appearance being insulted, and it's just, it's very confusing.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts. And then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye.
Well, the thing that drives me nuts is about all the focus on Sanders is that it was not about her appearance. She was just using the smoky eye as a vehicle. That was just a pure vehicle to talk about how she lies, how she stands up there and lies every damn day for this administration.
Also, if you think that comparing her to Aunt Lydia from The Handmaid's Tale is an insult to her appearance, fuck you. You're talking shit about Ann Dowd.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that wasn't the point either. And, like, I mean, things got so strange, though, with, like, the conversation around this whole set. And I think, you know, partially because there was this idea, everybody arguing about, like, was the smoky eye comment about looks or not. Actually, if you go and listen to her whole set, she actually took a shot at Chris Christie about his body, which I thought that was a moment where I was kind of like, no, don't do it.
Yeah.
Like, she said something about him being a barrel, basically, and that was lame. But, like, that Sanders, she clearly impeccably stayed away from making fun of her looks. Do you know what I mean?
Well, also, one of the balance things about, like, a roasty situation like that is normally, like, the president then gets up and hits back, you know? And, like, he voluntarily absented himself. It's not like Sarah Huckabee Sanders was going to do it. I mean, like, if she was there to be his proxy, shouldn't she have told some jokes?
Well, this is the thing, too, is that, like, the roast itself is, like, the most masculine male comedic structure you can possibly think of. I mean, the Dean Martin roast of yore was all dudes smoking cigars, talking about each other drinking and who can get the most pussy and who doesn't.
Like, this is a thing that is kind of fascinating to me because I think, like, roasts have been so masked. Like, I talked mad shit at the James Franco roast for, like, making constant homophobic jokes with no gay people there. And the difficulty with that. But at the same time, like, as somebody who wrote for Joan Rivers, there is a strong, like, tradition of feminine insult comedy that I love. And, like, Michelle was really sort of, like, hitting this beautiful point in between, like, male roastiness and lady cattiness that was good by me, you know?
I thought, too, I mean, just to go back to the idea that there were so many, like, strange little bubblings of conversation around this thing, I think my favorite weird thing was the New York Times Maggie Haberman and Kamel Nanjiani feuding on Twitter.
So beautiful.
What was that?
Okay, so Maggie Haberman said, I can't believe she insulted somebody's appearance. And, like, the way that the, like, people in the press have just been uniform about saying that this was horrible and an insult to the thing to the event. And Kumail said, like, hey, what is the line that you are saying is an insult to her appearance? And then Maggie unfollowed him. Oh. And he called her out for it. And she, it was, I thought it was a particularly lame retort of like, I have better things going on than to respond to you. And it's like, he's an Academy Award nominee who stars in a hit like TV show and like has a couple other TV shows and judged RuPaul's Drag Race last week. You don't get to tell Kumail Nanjiani that your New York Times columnist life is busier than
his. I think she also, I mean, she's known as like the authority in the New York Times on Trump. Like she's his right-hand man. She's supposedly the one that he calls first, the one that can get into a room with him, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like she demonstrates, and I say this with like massive respect for her, but I feel like she demonstrates the issues with journalists playing nice to keep access. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it seemed like in so many of those cases, it was people. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is the queen of the press corps. She gets to assign people, to the extent that I learned about this from CJ Craig on The West Wing, like she's assigning people space, she's controlling access. And so, like, I get why they are so terrified of her, but in a broader sense, the fact that we all just like defer to Trump when he says the most horrible things and then get in a huff when somebody talks shit back.
Which is exactly, there's a piece in the Washington Post where the writer was basically like, look, if you've never called out Trump for the numerous things that he said, calling Mexicans rapists, et cetera, then do not get offended by Michelle Wolf, a paid comedian's roast.
But also, Michelle has a new Netflix show that is starting in a month. Didn't she get everything that she could get out of this weekend?
Oh, my dear Lord. Like, her publicity team is like, well done, Michelle.
The thing is, Michelle Wolf, like, she probably has network publicity behind her. I wouldn't be surprised if she doesn't have a publicist. Like, this thing...
She does now.
Yeah, I mean... It was great. I thought it was delicious.
I just wanted to add in really quick, too, that, like, the white woman joke where she talks about what do we call another white woman that we're disappointed in, like an Uncle Tom or an Aunt Coulter, whatever it might be. I felt incredibly seen by that joke as a white woman that walks around with a lot of disappointment in the 53% of us who voted for Trump.
All right. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Westworld and Robots with Feelings. You're listening to Pop Rocket.
Hello, are you looking for a new comedy podcast? In which case, can I draw your attention to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast? It's a fictional industry podcast for the beef and dairy industries. It won Best Comedy at the 2017 British Podcast Awards, and it features wonderful guests such as Greg Davis.
To my knowledge, it's the only cow circus that's ever existed in this country. In rural Russia, every small town has a cow circus.
Josie Long.
You should have a beef. Have a beef with them. I have a beef with you. I will have a beef with you. Come round my house and I'll have a beef with you.
And Andy Daly.
That virus never existed. There was never any such thing as a mad cow disease. That was all an illusion that Big Lamb came up with.
That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts from. And I would recommend starting at episode one. Bye.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
Andrew T.
And season two of Westworld is underway, and the robots of the futuristic Wild West theme park are rebelling against their masters. I guess, like, the extent to which this show just drops you in a scene... You don't really know who the characters are. You don't know which timeline you're in. Like, there's totally a previously on Westworld. I don't know that it helps. But after having watched these two episodes, I am angry at this television show for the homework assignment it expects me to do to be able to follow the plot at all.
I would say, as somebody who's watched a total of 53 minutes of Westworld, which is the first 53 minutes of season two, episode one.
Perfect.
I was super confused. My wife watches the show. I had to ask a lot of questions. And, you know, I was able to piece many things together and kind of get the gist. But I was like, yeah. I'm like, what timeline are we in? What's up with that beach? Wait.
Like,
where is the beach?
Right. The thing is, and why is the beach?
Why is the beach?
The first season, it was a lot of fun, like, who's real, who's not? And there was that fun of, like, people showing up to a world full of sex robots and, like, who's just gonna want to shoot people? Who's just gonna want to fuck? And, like, and then, like, a third of the episode would be some sort of, like, puzzle you were supposed to put together. I still didn't like it.
It's like Escape Room the show. Like,
oh, that's so funny.
Like, every episode gives you just enough, like, mental work that it's like, you know, anyone can figure it out, but yeah. Like, it just gives you enough, like, busy work to do that you feel like you've accomplished something, even though you haven't done anything.
Well, and also, like, they're just such stupid and pointless and only within this world kind of things to figure out. Like, it is the worst parts of Battlestar Galactica and Lost in one show.
Who was it that tweeted out something like they wish that white people would spend as much of their energy working on other problems as they do figuring out Westworld?
Oh, that's very funny.
It does. Yeah, it feels like Westworld should be like a SETI kind of thing, like or like the way like CAPTCHAs actually solve AI or help AI problems. Just like just devote it. Just make those cycles mean something.
I mean, it is the thing of it is nice to be able to just like go to Wikipedia and be like, what the fuck happened there?
But there's the Westworld Wikipedia you're talking about, right?
Oh, I remember.
I recommend going there. If there's ever a Westworld show that wiki. A wiki is oh. made for, this is the
so
show.
So my game when I watch the show is I have a friend, Gabe Delahaye. Some people yeah. may know him. And I like watching that show with him. We watch it every week so that I can present my most like annoying theory about what just happened yeah. to make him upset. Because I'm just like, okay, I can spin something ridiculous that basically fits these patterns, like the pattern of facts here.
But what is it with dudes wanting these shows that are, like, complex and, like, uncooperative for the sake of being complex and uncooperative? Like, there's something similar with, like, Inception, like, these sort of reality's all fake. You don't know what it like. Who wants
it's the
these
Christopher
things?
Nolan world?
Yes. Yeah, there's. I think it's like Christopher Nolan. I think popularized the modern, the contemporary version of this, which is like sci-fi that makes dumb people feel smart.
Uh huh.
And because it's like it's sci-fi that asks a lot of philosophical questions and also thinks it is the first thing to ever have asked those questions.
Yeah.
So like, what is consciousness? Or like, my favorite is like Prometheus is one of those movies too, where it's basically like, is there a God? And it's like, I mean, okay, it's an interesting question to answer. It's not an interesting question to ask.
Yeah.
Like, and they all kind of fit this form of like sci-fi. And we're seeing it in season two of Westworld as opposed to season one that, like, really starts feeling itself because of its high production value and starts to think it's more philosophically than it is.
Dreams don't mean anything, Dolores. They're just noise. They're not real.
What is real?
That which is
the thing is, like, a lot of people are very critical of Game of Thrones for being too many characters and too much plotline and all of that. But, like, at least it doesn't entirely take place, like, in a dry part of the valley, you know? It's like, they're just always in this, like, they're either in a black room with glass walls or a dry part of the valley. And, like, it's impossible to... Maybe it is just, like, I am better suited to fantasy than I am to this. I don't know.
Well, Game of Thrones moves at a much more rapid clip. Westworld yeah. takes its time, for better or worse. I think sometimes that's a very successful strategy, and then other times you're like, okay, move it along. I think, you know, one of the pitfalls of the show, too, for me, is that they often just reiterate the theme. Like, each character gets to reiterate the theme. You know, like... I don't know how many times the man in black has said something to the, you know, effect of, this is the place where you find out who you really are.
Yeah.
And he just says that like over and over again in like different ways to different people. I like, for me, that character, the man in black played by Ed Harris, is the toughest one to get into, because I just feel like there's nothing, I don't know how his story is advancing. Like, he's just kind of the guy that is the biggest fanboy and has the best shot. And whereas I feel like Evan Rachel Wood and Thandi Newton, those two characters are like hooking me in.
Yeah.
Like, and honestly, I could watch all day Evan Rachel Wood just doing the dead robot face and then going, I'm back online, or whatever she says. Like, there is something about watching her like constantly do that that I'm like, yes, I just want it on a loop and I'll just watch that.
End of last season, the moment when Thandi Newton gets to like the trains and then turns back around, and this moment of like, what's personality and what's programming? Like, there are things like that that are fun. There were also, like, this season, I mean, that at the end of the day, this is a TV show about the fact that, like, dudes like to fuck objects and are angry that women are human beings now and have been for around 17 years. like, when you had Thandi Newton...
Was that when Sephora opened 17 years?
Once you guys had ready and convenient access to clay masks, things really just came together.
Things accelerated then.
But, like, Thandi Newton having the, like white dude programmer strip naked the way she's had to be naked yes. So many times, I was like...
And show some peen, let's just say that.
Yeah, and it's a fun energy. I don't know that I'm getting any... thought.
Well, I don't know. Is it so? It does seem like the arc, at least as far as I can follow it or heard about it, is that, you know, it is about largely these female objects coming into consciousness as
yes.
subjects, mm-hmm. and there is a kind of consciousness raising aspect to it too, where then they're moved to mutiny and activism, and you know, at least I think that's better than the forms of, like, I don't know, sentient lady robot rebellion that we get from something like Ex Machina, which is, to me, was like one of the worst films ever.
Really? Oh, yeah. I liked it.
Oh, did you? I was just like, what is this crap?
But mainly because I wanted to like live in that house, like, honestly.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's definitely architecture.
I've heard that you can stay there.
Yeah, it's like in the middle of like Norway.
Yeah,
or something,
but it's like a hotel-ish type situation. Maybe not.
I got to book this.
Yeah.
but I also felt like, you know, and what's the deal with like the Asian lady robot skin?
It was, you know,
Karen, at the end of last season of Westworld, they tease that there's like I think they call it Shogun World. I tweeted when I saw it, oh, Eastworld is in the house. But I think they call it Shogun World. But also it's like, hey, if you thought like the line of greasy straight white dudes lined up outside of the Western themed sex park was gross, like the one that goes to the Japanese sex park is like the end of the world. Like, that train just needs to go straight to hell.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Blade Runner for a minute. I mean, like, these stories of guys falling in love with dead-eyed women who are, you know, they want to believe, are sad because they're not real and the man's love can make them real. I'm tired.
No, I mean, just to sort of loop back to Shogun World for a second, though, I mean, it's interesting, you know, what we also get in Blade Runner, at least its first iteration, is this, you know, you get this techno-orientalism thing. And one of the reasons I feel like there is always going to be some kind of Asian robot is mm-hmm. that common, like, trope of, like, people in the Western world perceiving Asians as basically on the kind of robotic spectrum of experience.
Yes.
Anyway.
I think that's because you guys aren't people. You're just teeming masses.
Yeah, teeming masses, work, like, really
emotionless
good workers.
Teeming masses.
Yeah, emotionless teaming
that
masses.
That made your stuff.
And so there's not, I mean, that's why, like, you know, even films like Her, Mm-hmm. Yes. Where, you know, you're supposed to be in Los Angeles and you know, but yet everybody's like looks like a kind of white person, like doing like retro 40s looks.
Super high pants.
Yeah, super high pants. It gets, you know, it gets confusing.
Which is like, why is that the future?
Yeah, yeah, that's the future. It's like everything high waisted. But it's interesting that you don't get to see, like, I don't know, more Asian people.
Yeah. It's always like the signifier in that type of sci-fi of like futurist orientalism is like white people who are really comfortable eating noodles.
Yeah.
And you're like,
yeah,
you're like,
sure.
Oh, this is could not be more a white guy in LA wrote this, because I get it. You think that makes you special, but like,
right. That is all we want in terms of acclimation.
Karen, as our musicals expert and our Victorianist, like our AI stories always fundament, like, are they always Pygmalion stories, or are these like separate tropes?
I think that we've gone through different phases of the kind of Pygmalion or Pinocchio story, right? Where, you know, even something like Bicentennial Man, he wishes really hard to be a real person, and love will bring, you know, turn him into that kind of, you know, wonderful humanesque or human. It will transpose you into human, there's another one that's just evading me, but
AI.
It's just, well, there is AI, but you know, yeah, I want to be a real boy. I think that in many respects, or even Battlestar Galactica, if we like think through the Cylons and their reproductive energies, it's like, you know, as soon as we are able to do this fundamentally human thing and have a kind of reproductive hybrid experience, then, you know, that's where we broach the human. I think it's just a matter of like really sorting out what it is that is going to affect that transformation, whether or not it is love or attention or care or manners or childbirth, right?
Well, I think all of these movies have the thread of like empathy, right? Like the challenge comes when the robot starts to act human or starts to seem human. And I feel like in AI, it's like heartbreaking when you see the boy. I mean, I actually really love AI in many ways. I think it's an interesting merging two of those two directors' visions. But at any rate, like when you see the boy like have these emotions on his face, but then your logic knows, well, but he's not human. What kind of emotions am I seeing? I think that's always like an interesting question to think about. Like, what, you know, do we feel? I mean, it's like in this way that when people talked about, there's that like, what was that like study a while ago where like people think of their iPhones almost like the same way they think of their pets, where they have like some kind of like empathy for their iPhone and like worried about it losing it in the same way that you worry about losing a pet. At any rate, yeah, we're attached. But yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's happening with like Dolores's story in particular, that like she started as this, you know, very like Western Disney princess type of character that you just, even though she was getting assaulted, you didn't, you could watch that and you still didn't feel that much for her because you knew she was a robot and she acted the same way every day. She went through the script. And as soon as she starts to break from the script, that's when you're like worried for her and concerned for her. But now the darker she's getting, the more vengeful she's getting, the more murderous she's getting. It's like, what happens to your empathy then?
Well, there was something so interesting about Tandy Newton's change hinging on an awareness of all of these other lives she had, and sort of like a woman becoming aware of all of the various kinds of mistreatment that a woman experiences, and that changing her. The thing is, at the end of the day, I'm always going to like the reboot of Battlestar Galactica better because those AI showed up with a philosophy. Like, they showed up with we're a different thing that is on par with you and maybe better, and really had a strong...
a belief system, and system of worship.
And also sort of like something that like queered the biological bodies that were there and was really saying like, are you really the maker, or are you like the inferior thing that came before us? Like, are you just our evolutionary would progenitor be the word? I don't know. But like, that felt rich and like there was somewhere to go. And I just feel like Westworld is like coming up with it on the fly.
Yeah, it's like this thing where I think the problem with this and a lot of the sci-fi that we've been talking about is that it's missing the thing that's in front of their face, which is like, or maybe it wants to have it both ways. So like, as a metaphor about how women are treated like objects, very interesting. But then also you have the Man in Black character who is like just the gamer, basically. Yeah. And you're like, yeah, okay. And it is this thing. So like, you know, your average Gamergate alt-right person, incel is the thing that they love now, is like those are people that see their Xbox as more like human than a woman.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's this thing where it's like, it's so close to being able to talk about something like that, but it can't because it still needs to stick with this robot metaphor.
Well, there is something kind of annoying about the fact that, like, we've now had MMOs in a vital way in our lives for, like, 15, 20 years, and that we still don't know how to tell stories within that. Like, the Warcraft movie was terrible. Like, all of... I mean, the South Park episode is maybe still the best exploration of, like, how you relate to an MMO. And the first season of this show, I was like, oh my God, it's a drama set in, like, inside an MMO, and now I'm tired of it, and I don't care.
Well, because it doesn't explore... It sort of explores, but then immediately shrugs its shoulders at the fact that, like, the thing that makes playing video games with other people bad is other people.
Yeah.
It's not the game, or it's not, like, how attached you become to the world. It's because you're with the worst people, or at least exposed to the possibility of being exposed to the worst people.
Well, and
at
also
all
the
times.
Worst sides of people who know that they're not going to see you again and, you know, will steal that dagger that is not right for their class. So it's this very, like, common trope since fucking Greek mythology that dude makes a lady and then falls in love with this object lady that he made. Do women ever make men? Do women want to make men?
We forgot that in 1987, it actually wasn't a woman who made a man, but it was a man who replicated himself.
Uh-huh.
And
of course it's like that. Yeah.
Let me just duplicate myself.
Yes, but it's 1987, Making Mr. Right, starring John Malkovich and Anne Magnuson. And actually, so he creates a humanoid, like human android double named Ulysses, who's a replica of himself, but he is a much more charming and emotional being than the actual scientist, right? So, I don't know. Some stuff happens and you know, Mr. Wright, the robot, or Ulysses, gets to, like, have some action and then help facilitate love, empathy, desire for the robotic science human guy. But I think that that's one of the kind of narratives. I for some reason, I had in my mind remembered it that incorrectly that a woman made Mr. Right.
Does he ever go wrong in a Jekyll-y kind of way?
He does flip out a little bit. I mean, I think that there are things that he does that become awkward, but people just think, oh, isn't that charming? You know, isn't that charming, this guy, like, stumbling around? But I guess it was supposed to be kind of answer to, like, weird science.
Yeah.
Or something like that, which is also another great, like, you know, little dorky dudes, like, making an ideal woman.
Can I talk, though, too, about her? Because I think that is also illuminating in terms of, like, why it is always coming from the male point of view, like, the man making the dream woman robot. I think partially because there are certain things built into the robot story that really play into fears in the male psyche. And I think, for instance, her, like, really gets into this, like, okay, so Theodore Joaquin Phoenix, he falls in love with the operating system Samantha, played by Scarlett Johansson. And as Samantha learns more and more, she grows bored of him and basically wants out. And I feel like that is a major fear, like the rejection fear. I mean, we all fear getting rejected, but I feel like it's particularly baked into a certain kind of male, into the male id. And like,
well, because it's like you want to have a thing. You've been taught you get a thing that you can control.
Absolutely.
And then all of a sudden, a woman, I guess, can be
willful.
Smarter than you or willful. Yeah.
Yeah. And in a way, I feel like, you know, this is her is directed by Spike Jonze, who is a major hipster. And I feel like it's like a male hipster worry as well, that like as soon as I teach her all about my cool music and skateboarding, she's going to be like, bye.
Well,
like
when
she's able to pick it up herself.
Who was like eclipsed by his ex.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is like, right? Isn't that what that movie is about?
Well, one of the interesting things I never thought about before with Westworld is we're constantly talking about this financial structure and investors and everything like that. And one of the, like, usually in a, like, lady robot kind of story, like, because she is your property, she's not going to go away. And then, uh-oh, she becomes too willful and she does still go away.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something so weird about this corporate structure not giving any man sort of like the clear ownership over Tandy Newton or Evan Rachel Wood that they would have back under traditional marriage.
It's true. Like, in just old-timey marriage, they'd be better off.
Yeah.
Can I one thing about the women making ideal dude robots, at least with Hollywood the way it is, I kind of worry that like the 80s 90s version of it would just be about like the stereotype of women trying to control men or change their man, but like a Kay Cannon version of this maybe we're ready for.
I would say the closest is possibly My Big Fat Greek Wedding. My anger at that movie always was she puts him through fucking everything and he's never a person at any point in time. But there was a really good script on The Blacklist like 2 years ago that was premised on, it was actually a girl I know, Mackenzie Dore, I worked with her, but it is a girl makes robot of perfect man kind of thing. And hers was more sophisticated than that. But you're always going to go into those like hack dynamics of gender.
Well, yeah, the male robot would just be sensitive, talk about his feelings, give foot massages. Do you want more hack references?
But always be able to get hard as soon as you need him to be hard.
Correct.
All right.
And we'll help you move.
He's so strong. All right, you are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the hosts of Everything's Coming Up Simpsons. We are a Simpsons podcast brand new to the Maximum Fun Network, and every episode we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright, all people that have worked on The Simpsons, and we've also had guests like Weird Al and people that are on the Max Fun Network already, and each week we will talk to a very cool guest about their favorite episode, and it is so much fun. So if you like The Simpsons, come listen to Everything's Coming Up Simpsons.
All right, smell you later.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson.
I should have gone first, Andrew T. I got that low.
No, your lowest ranking, okay? This is like the Supreme Court or cabinet.
I wasn't sure if we went back and forth in the order.
Wobbler's been here since, like, what, 2003?
I've been here since before Christ, okay?
My question is, do I go where it says Winter's name, or do I just wait? I'm going to wait my turn
you
from now on.
You need to wait your turn. All right. Karen, every week on Pop Rocket, we ask the age-old question, what is your current jam? So we turn to you, the queen of the pop conference, and ask you, what is your current jam?
I decided to go really trashy this week because, number one, because my musical taste is already trashy, and because I also wanted to work through, or at least present a theory about Maroon 5. Maroon 5, a band that people hate. It's not much of a theory other than that we can think of Maroon 5 as to Los Angeles, as Train is to San Francisco, as Fun is to Brooklyn.
Whoa.
If there's a way that you can kind of think about
I'm mapping.
Bands. Uh-huh. I mean, and you could, you know, if we were back in the 90s, we could say Third Eye Blind is essentially the precursor to, like, you know, is to San Francisco Bay Area as Maroon 5 is to Los Angeles. I find them, you know, because they are an LA band, there's so much about them that I do find predictably odious. Mm. And Adam Levine is just, you know, one of those people who he's like a min pin, like a little miniature pincher. And I'm just like, it's somebody who I'm supposed to really loathe. And that voice is kind of annoying. And yet every damn time Maroon 5, you get me with
they are a hit machine.
Hooky melodies.
They are hooky, and he's got one of the finest falsettos in the business.
Well, it's so true. And I do want him to beat Blake Shelton more often on The Voice with his coaching. So this week's jam is What Lovers Do with Maroon 5 featuring SZA. There's something vaguely infantile about all of their songs. But that's, I think that's what, where it touches my soul the most.
I surrendered a while ago. I just did. I'm just like, I'm letting it in my heart.
Yeah. I will see them at the LA County Fair in 20 years.
I have a theory. It relates back to our previous segment. I would like to float it here. Like, men want to create a physical object who has been programmed to do what they want and all of that. Is it possible that a woman's equivalent of a sex robot is just a hot Jew who has been properly whipped by his mother, Adam Levine style, so that, like, you know, he will go get you a cup of coffee in the morning?
I mean, sounds pretty good to me.
And his proactive commercials means that he had a rough time at some point.
Exactly. He was vulnerable. He knows about skincare. Yeah. I mean, that's huge.
Margaret, what's your jam?
I am going with the Pointer Sisters because I really love how optimistic we all were about robots in the 80s. Like, we were okay with being robots and loving robots and even having robots as cops shoot us, apparently, evidenced by RoboCop. This is their worldwide hit, Automatic, and this features Ruth Pointer doing her best sexy male robot voice. My hands perspire, shaped like the leaf. Up and down goes my temperature. I summon doctors to get some relief, but they tell me there is no cure. They tell me no way to control it. Well, 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 well. Get that lady baritone in there.
This is the jam. I love Automatic.
Right? I love
this
song.
It's like one of my favorites.
I also interviewed Anita Pointer, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And little known fact about her, she has a ginormous collection of black memorabilia.
Oh,
like,
really?
Like, rooms and rooms filled with things, like, from every decade, like pre-slavery on. It's amazing. Yeah, little known fact. Just put that in your stash.
How old were they when in the 80s? Because in my head, they were like in their 40s.
Yeah, I do think they were. Yeah, a little older.
There was something cool about having just like this girl group of like mature women in the 80s who were just hit after hit after hit.
I mean, they were making music in the 70s. Like, that's just when they popped like big time.
Yeah.
But they had already been around the block and then some.
I have listened to Neutron Dance multiple times in the past week.
Lovely.
Andrew T, do you have a jam?
My jam is something that had been my jam a couple months ago, kind of fell off, and then on Sunday night, my phone blew up a little bit because I'm on this text thread with a bunch of Chinese people in Hollywood, and this group, this rap group that we'd all gotten into, they're going to get mad because some of them have been into them way longer. But I got introduced a couple months ago. This group called the Higher Brothers, who are out of Chengdu, I believe. And it's like Chengdu trap music.
Wow.
And it is like the coolest, most confident like music. It's definitely music I wish I'd had access to when I was a teenager. Because
yeah.
I think it would have solved a lot of problems for me. Get bitch mad or says pay, made in China. Your high brother black car, made in China. She said that she didn't love me. She said that she didn't love me. She said that she didn't love me. She lied, she lied. The reason it came up is because they played out the credits to Silicon Valley this week with this song. Yeah.
Ah.
And that's why. So these guys are in the culture now, the American culture. But yeah, it's
they
just
have a
like
good music supervisor. Sorry to interrupt, but Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah. I think it's, I mean, and I don't know. For this, I was just like, this is like, yeah, it's the music I wish I'd had when I was a young teen.
Mm-hmm.
Not that long ago, of course, everyone.
It is always fun to be like happy that something exists and angry that you didn't have it when you needed it.
Yeah.
I do not have a jam. I'm just going to tell people, if it's all right with the other panelists, I'm going to ask people to buy my book.
Do it. Give us like a tasty line or something. Make that your jam.
I got nothing prepared. I have a book coming out in July. It is called My Life as a Goddess. Please pre-order it. From any source, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or one of that indie bullshit that Margaret is always supporting because she loves our independent bookstores.
Can you talk about your cover shot? Because it's a work of beauty.
That's so sweet. Yes, I showed up to a cover shot and they like had dead flowers for me to hold and had told me to bring like an array of Oxfords, and I was a little bit like, oh, no, no, no.
Yeah.
That's not what I should be doing. And I was very much like, can we do this topless? Should we do this topless? And I think they were scared. And I was like, I have a thing I could drape over myself. And I drove home to get it. And while I was there, while I was driving, I located the closest flower shop and was like, can you make a wreath of roses, but not for a 7-year-old girl, for a man with a gigantic head? And they were like, coming so we can measure it. And it all came. And like the photographer was super great. And it like came together. And I am happy with it. So thank you for bringing it up, Margaret.
I loved it. I feel like I want another shot of that, except I want you holding a baby goat. Like, maybe you're going to sacrifice it, or maybe it's just your pal.
That's wonderful. Maybe I'm just, like, maybe it's just male fertility. Maybe, like,
yeah.
All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wobbler, Karen Thompson, and our new temporary permanent host, Mr. Andrew T. Also, be sure to listen to his podcast, Yo, Is This Racist? And where can people follow you on social?
Andrew T. Last name is spelled T-I, and it's all caps.
He's very good work on social media.
Thank you.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Nizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to the 5-star reviews in Apple Podcasts. If you haven't already, please review us. It keeps Margaret healthy. She has a husband and child to think of now. If you guys make her infirm by not reviewing us and she is taken from Silas's life, it's on your heads. This week, we give thanks to Randall Skeffington, who captioned his review with the description, Hellenistic model of homosexual mentorship.
It was a beautiful line, Karen.
this podcast makes a great case for why pop culture matters, and the hosts bring a nice mix of consumer enthusiasm and intellectual rigor to the show. It's so enjoyable to hear their different and complementary ways of contextualizing media. Longest yeah boy ever. That's a good contender for best name. Winter talking about Ben Affleck as her problematic fave has made me feel seen. Thank you. K-Burn 1202 writes, Margaret's sophisticated takes without being pretentious. Karen's tanks are often deliciously pretentious but still joyful. Oh, when she gets that French pronunciation in there. Winter throwing out whatever Winter is going to throw out there, a guy holding it all together with his brainy silliness. K-Burn also noted one technical area that we could improve, and that was a productive note. So thanks to him. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We've got our Instagram account back, and Wobbler and Thompson have been keeping it alive.
At Pop Rocket Podcast.
Wow.
Join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is Laura Swisher, whom I have known for like 15 years now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.